ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, it's the music show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford.
The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Hey, that's me and I want you only. Don't turn me home again, I just can't face myself. Inside, darling, you know just what I'm here for. So you're scared and you're thinking that maybe we ain't that young anymore. Show a little faith, there's magic in the night. You ain't a beauty, but hey, you're alright. Oh, and that's alright with me.
I have seen rock and roll's future. And its name is Bruce Springsteen, said John Landau, shortly before producing Born to Run. Bruce Springsteen's third studio album was released 50 years ago this week. Heady influences of Roy Orbison, Dylan, and the Vietnam War catapulted Springsteen and the E Street Band from New Jersey dive bars to the big time. On today's show, we're getting in the passenger seat. And that's how the album begins, Thunder Road, the opening track of Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. We have two Springsteen fans joining us today, the writer and critic Karen Goldsworthy and singer-songwriter and academic Toby Martin. Welcome to you both. Karen, I might start with you. You and Bruce, how did you get together?
Bruce and I got together one night in 1976. When I was listening to Adelaide Student Radio. There were a couple of very cluey boys who ran a program, and one night they just played Born to Run, and it just blew me away completely. I'd never heard anything like it.
I love this first track. I think it's my favourite track, actually, on the album.
It's like he's dealing with this kind of classic rock and roll poetry of escapism. Tonight we'll be free.
Thank you.
very Bruce Springsteen, this daily grind of life and capitalism, and we've got to escape it and have a real passionate experience. I guess for him that's often about a road and a car as well.
Yes.
So that's where they're heading.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes. Did you go back, Karen, and listen to earlier albums after you discovered this one? I mean, did you situate Bruce's latest album with his two previous ones?
Yeah, I certainly did. After I listened to that song, I went out and bought Born to Run and also the two previous ones, and I lived on brown rice till the next scholarship check. Just immediately, you know, it was just, and in a way I actually found the earlier two almost more exciting because they were different. There was this person out there and you didn't know he was there until you listened to all this stuff together, and then you just realised how good he was.
Yes. And Rosalita on The Wild, The Innocent and The East Street Shuffle is kind of a manifesto song, isn't it? And all of the other girls, including Mary on Thunder Road, are kind of versions of Rosalita.
I think Rosalita's kind of a boys' song, so it's not a favourite with me the way it seems to be with lots of blokes. My favourite on that album is the piano intro to New York City Serenade, which is just astonishing. One thing I noticed about this album, I must say, about Born to Run, listening to it now, is how piano forward it is. I had never realised that before.
Yes, and when it isn't the piano, it's the organ. The keyboards are key. Mm. And we have to mention, I think, right up front, the Glockenspiel, because that's a really surprising instrument to find on a major rock album. But there it is, right on the first song, and it's going to come back again. Toby, any thoughts on the Glockenspiel?
I love it. I mean, it's like Born to Run is an amazing single, and yeah, the Glockenspiel is the icing on the cake, I think, for that song. It's an amazing part. And I think the Glockenspiel kind of doubles something else, or partially doubles maybe a guitar line. And it's like that combination. It's very inventive.
Yes.
Great, great studio stuff.
And at the end, it doubles Clarence Clemons, who right. makes his triumphant appearance on the Coda, an authentic Coda, introducing new musical material at the end of the song. And this is, having said that this is my favourite track, the Coda, in a sense, is my greatest disappointment with the album because it doesn't go on long enough. Oh, yeah. And in live performance, Clarence would go round and round and round with that bit, and it fades too soon on the album, I think. This is track two, 10th Avenue Freeze Out. Avenue Freeze Out. It's the second track from Springsteen's Born to Run, 50 years old this year. It's a song about a gang, and the gang is the East Street Band, I think it's fair to say, Toby.
It's such a beautiful reference to soul, and particularly country soul, I guess. It reminds me of Stax, Muscle Shoals recordings from probably about a decade earlier than that. That horn section and those refined minimal guitar riffs. So it's like Bruce Springsteen, the band, are sort of taking this amazing history of black music and, I guess, channeling it into something new and different. And it's interesting that they use that musical style as their autobiographical statement.
I mean, you mentioned the sound of the brass, and that is down to Stephen Van Zandt. It's his contribution to this album. He's not yet the E Street Band's guitarist. He is the arranger of the brass on this track. It's remarkable to think of that. Tell them a new freeze out. Karen, your feelings about 10th Avenue Freeze Out. This is a boy song, really, too.
Sure, I'm not against boy songs, you understand. I never understood it, but I always enjoy just rocking along with it. I've always sort of listened to this album as an album. So to me, this was just the next chapter in the album or in the story of that night. I never understood what was going on at all until I started reading very recently his autobiography properly instead of just in bits and pieces. But the other thing is that a freeze-out is a thing in poker. I didn't know that until last night, but it explains a lot.
I didn't know that until you told me.
There you go.
So, thank you. Don't say you don't learn things from the music show. I'm all alone. I can't go home. There's a lot of loneliness on this album. In the first track, Roy Orbison is singing for the lonely. That's a kind of key thing here. That plus other music. I mean, Roy Orbison on this one, we've got a transistor blasting from a tenement window. So it's kind of, there's background noise on this album, Toby. Maybe it shuts out the loneliness.
My first intro into Bruce Springsteen was the record Nebraska. And So we were on tour in America and Patrick, our bass player, loved it and he put it on. I'd never really heard much Bruce Springsteen before. You know, Born in the USA was kind of like like the air you breathe when you're growing up in the 1980s, but I'd never really engaged with it. And yeah, we listened to it. I think we were actually driving through the Midwest, probably somewhere near Nebraska at the time. It is such a lonely sound. That record in particular and the characters that inhabit that record, it's just like, I mean, it's just, and it's the perfect title, you know, sort of the plains of the Midwest and the sort of stripped back acoustic nature of it. And yeah, I think the individual trying to find some passionate release and meaning and that very lonely kind of struggle. And yeah, Born to Run, it's kind of the same character, but they're sort of surrounded by all this noise of the city because, you know, Born to Run is such a city album. There's so many references to Harlem and Jersey and the mean streets and all that kind of stuff. But centrally, yeah, there's this figure who's fairly lonely. Yeah.
And yet he's surrounded by his gang.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of West Side Story in that sense, particularly the last, I mean, I'm not there yet, particularly Jungle Land. It's got this, yeah, the gang in New York and, you know, they're swapping knives for guitars and all that kind of thing. It's a romantic kind of figure, I suppose.
Yes. He uses that song, 10th Avenue Freeze Out, in concerts as the moment when the band is introduced. In fact, we can actually hear him at Madison Square Garden doing just that.
Secretary of the Brotherhood. Do I have to say his name? Do I have to say his name? Say who? 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 Say who?
Bruce Springsteen introducing the big man, Clarence Clemens, at Madison Square Garden, and Clarence playing his tenor sax. That's quite an amazing moment, isn't it, really? He's underlining the fact that he's not just a solo artist, that they're a brotherhood. And at the same time, he's holding court, or maybe he's preaching, Karen.
He's using something that Obama used to such brilliant effect, and that's the classic call and response structure.
Oh, yeah.
Which, again, is churchy.
Yeah.
I just kept thinking of Billy Graham when I was listening to that and thinking, you know, he's taking in everything from American culture from the day he was born and using it in performance.
Yeah, I couldn't work out if you sound like a revivalist preacher or a politician, but it's like, yeah, I think you're right. It's like obviously both, yeah, and people channeling that same tradition.
Both.
Yeah.
Yes. Let's move on to Night, because this is a song that really introduces the working man figure, which is such an important trope in Springsteen's music. Yeah,
to work late in the boss man's
That's Night, track three from Bruce Springsteen's 1975 album Born to Run, and Glockenspiel's back. I just wanted to point that out. And also there's a harpsichord there if you listen hard, which is a really odd thing to find on any Springsteen album, especially this one. Karen, you work all day to blow them away in the night.
I was really pleased to hear Toby bring up West Side Story because I only thought of that last night too. But the other movie that's behind that is, of course, Saturday Night Fever. You know, these working class boys in their working class jobs, and then they get all glitzed up to go out and dance. You know, it's very much the same dynamic, and it hadn't even occurred to me till that very second. But the other thing that I kept thinking of was, of all things, and bear with me here, Peter Temple's The Broken Shore and his other books, where the trope he uses again and again for his beleaguered male characters is that they go out into the day. It's as though the day was an actual thing, a character, a set or something. And step out into the night is exactly the same kind of way of thinking about it. It'll be light, and it'll be tonight.
And The Night is a release, isn't it, for Springsteen and the characters in Springsteen's song. It's where you can be yourself.
Well, it's not something you've got to wrestle with the way it is in Peter Temple, but I think on the whole, Springsteen's a much more cheery. Sounds like a crazy thing to say about someone who suffers from clinical depression, but he's a much more cheery character than Temple was, I think. His worldview is much more cheerful.
Well, yes, I mean, the music's cheery. It's dance music. And there are some tracks on this album which are pure dance music. But the words are, you know, that's where the clinical depression shows itself, because they're often desperate words.
Mm, indeed. I think that was one of the things that I found so exciting when the first time I heard Born to Run the song, was that the lyrics seemed to be not exactly at odds with the music. It's this beautiful driving beat. But then you listen to what's being sung and you think, oh, hang on. It works. It shouldn't, but it does somehow.
Yes. Toby.
The juxtaposition of lyrics and music, yeah, is really interesting. And I would say it's also that Bruce Springsteen manages to find a language to dramatise very ordinary stories. And I think he uses very plain and everyday language and situations which a lot of people can't understand, but he puts it to this extremely grand, elaborate backdrop. I mean, Born to Run is a very, very big sounding record. I mean, it's like the piano playing is full on all the time. It's this wall of sound. It's like, yeah, there's glockenspiels and harmonicas and harpsichords. but yeah, there's kind of this very cinematic, big scape. And then within that, there's these very kind of down-to-earth stories.
This is track four. This is Backstreets. And here's that piano.
Thank you.
And this is a kind of typical Springsteen shape for a song, something that starts small and acoustic and ends up huge, in this case with Springsteen screaming the chorus, Toby.
He's always fighting with the band in his singing. Simon Frith is a sort of famous pop music academic, wrote a very famous essay about Bruce Springsteen in the 80s called The Real Thing. And one of the things he says is that you always get this sense that Bruce Springsteen is really fighting with the band to compete for volume, you know, and he's a real rock singer in that sense, that it's not, they're not giving him space. They're like, everyone's really going for it, and he's got to work very hard to sing. I mean, and work and labour is such a big part of Bruce Springsteen. It's in how he dresses, it's in the people he writes about, and it's in how he sings too. It's just like, you see the work, and he does these four-hour shows, and you see him working hard and like sweating, and his voice is raw and ripped at the end, and it's all part of that package.
And he shows up on time too. I mean, if it's billed as an 8 o'clock concert, he's on stage at a minute past eight. So, you know, don't be late. Yeah. There isn't going to be a support act.
And then at the end, when I saw him play anyway, the last hours, all the lights on the audience, you know, sort of everyone's in the same light. And you're sort of all together in this kind of non-stadium light, and the band is still just kind of going for it.
I saw him in 81 in the UK in the Birmingham Entertainment Centre, and he walked out. They started with Hungry Heart, which was in the charts at the time and which has a family resemblance to the song we've just heard. Mm. And he walked out and he was holding the microphone out in front of him, pointing at the audience, and the audience sang the first verse.
Yeah, well.
You know, and so we were already at that level of energy.
Don't need to ask them to sing along. They're already doing it, yeah.
Well, Karen, is there a kind of, it's maybe a silly question, is there a literary equivalent of this kind of work ethic in Springsteen and in some other musicians as well, do you think?
Well, Shakespeare. And closer to home, Peter Carey, who churned out bloody good novels once every 3 years for years and years and years. There are writers who do it. There are people like, you know, Helen Garner will go into her study and she won't come out till she's done the work she told herself she was going to do. I think a lot of really great writers have a very, very disciplined attitude to what they're doing. It's only because it's not a workplace as such that people tend to not think of it as work, I think.
Yes, but there's also the relationship with the audience as well, which we should probably, this is maybe the moment to talk about it, because Springsteen's is almost, you know, second to none, isn't it?
There's a wonderful bit in his autobiography. This is clearly the result of years of therapy, where he talks about his relationship with his father. And he says that because his father was a difficult, silent, hostile man, he said he grew up, you know, having to provide both sides of any conversation with his father to try and understand what was going on with his father and what the problem was. And he says in his autobiography that he thinks this gave him a capacity for empathy. He says he's got to put himself in the shoes of the other person because he got so much practice at it when he was young. You know, the better you are at understanding what's going on in somebody else's mind, the easier it's going to be to connect with an audience. You know, if you watch someone like Joni Mitchell, for example, although the audience is mesmerised by her, she doesn't have that sort of connection with an audience, not in my experience of seeing her anyway. She doesn't have that kind of connection with an audience that somebody like Springsteen has got. She doesn't need it. She's doing other brilliant stuff, but she doesn't have it.
It's kind of
a different language, though, isn't it? Because I think I've never seen Joni Mitchell play, but there are some performers who quite deliberately try and put the wall between them and the audience, and as an artistic kind of performance, like a decision you make about the kind of performer you want to be.
Van Morrison is the obvious one. Yep. I remember seeing him two nights in a row in London, and the only words he said were, thank you, good night.
Yep.
And he only said that one night.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you go to hear him sing. That's why you're there. And let's just get on with it.
Totally. I mean, the relationship with the audience, he's really tried very hard to make the stadium show seem as intimate as possible, I think. I mean, the E Street Band are famously called the world's biggest bar band or the most famous. But this idea that they're trying to bring what you might see in your local bar or pub on a Friday night, they are trying to put that on a very large stage in front of you and have that kind of connection. I mean, he does it really amazingly well, considering he's playing in front of tens of thousands of people. It's a pretty impressive thing to do. I got to say, at the concert I went to, because it was an E Street Band concert, the whole time I was expecting within 4 hours there to be an acoustic moment, you know, where he might, because he's got, you know, I mean, I mentioned Nebraska before, but there's other acoustic songs on all his records. And it never happened at the gig I went to. And because it was an E Street Band gig, it was never going to happen. Like, that, I got the wrong conception. But it was like, one hand slightly disappointed not hear those songs. On the other, it's not just 4 hours. It's 4 hours of like nonstop bar band music. Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and I'm joined at the moment by Toby Martin, singer, songwriter and academic, and Karen Goldsworthy, writer and critic. And we are talking about Born to Run on the occasion of its 50th birthday. And it's time to turn the record over and hear the title track. Born to Run from Born to Run, Bruce Springsteen was celebrating the 50th anniversary of the album on today's music show. Where to start with this? There's an awful lot to say about this song. Maybe we should start with the characters. Mary is now Wendy. There's a long list of girls' names. I did once go through Springsteen songs making a list. In this one, it's just Wendy and Bruce, isn't it?
She's a kind of every girl. You know, all these ladies, the Marys, the Wendys, the Terrys, although Terry is a bit ambiguous. As a contemporary of Springsteen, well, he's 4 years older than me. It makes me feel quite young. When I first heard that song, we as women had a place in those songs, but we were the ones who danced across the porch and sat in the passenger seat. And if we were lucky, you know, if we were hot, which most of us weren't, we got to hang around in doorways. So in those early songs, as a female listener, you were really just positioned as a Mary or a Wendy. That's where we were kind of coming from, listening to the music. Beyond the palace, semi-barred drums, scream down the boulevard. Girls comb their hairs in rearview mirrors, and the boys try to look so hot. The amusement park rides and falls and start. Kids are up on the beach in the mist. I want to die with you, Wendy, on the street tonight, and another lasting kiss.
This is the song of escape, isn't it? Sprung from cages, you know, riding through mansions of glory. This is the music lifting up the desperation of the words.
It's full of imagery from the Bible. Holy, holy things and mansions of glory and paradise, and they're heading for heaven, which is a fairly sinister idea when you think about it.
I mean, we were talking before about the ordinary language that Bruce Springsteen uses, but this is quite elaborate. Like, I mean, you mentioned biblical, but it's quite elaborate. There's suicide machines and mansions of glory. It's quite picturesque language. He's sort of riffing on that American 50s chrome Buick highway thing, and he's kind of twisting it to make it this slightly darker place. The whole sort of wall of sound Phil Spector thing that he was going for on this record. This song is like when everything makes so much sense.
There's a good example of composing craft in the song that I think it's worth mentioning as well, which is the last verse. You know, he counts us in with the 1, 2, 3, 4, and the highway's jammed with broken heroes. Finally, he slams together two themes on top of each other, the sung line and the riff that we've been hearing all the way through. And that's the sort of device that, you know, in classical music, when that happens, I'm thinking of Berlioz, Romeo and Juliet, for instance, in the Capulet's Ball, or in Debussy, Fête, where you're hearing themes separately and then suddenly, bang, they're played simultaneously. And it's thrilling here too.
Yeah.
So, it's a musical payoff, I think, on an album that's full of musical payoffs.
It's a bit like the record has competing voices. You know, we're talking before about Bruce has got he's got to fight against the voices, and there's the saxophone and there's the guitar lines, and in moments like that, the voices really kind of sink into a kind of a structure that's really beautiful and stop kind of all going for it and do that.
But it's also, I mean, without wishing to kind of stretch credulity too far, but you could say that the putting of those two themes on top of each other is symbolic as well of the subject, because they've just had an everlasting kiss. Well, I assume if it's everlasting, they're still in the middle of it. And he wants to die with her in an everlasting kiss, which is, I mean, I mentioned Berlioz, but that's Wagnerian. Is that going too far, Karen?
I'm with you.
There's a word for it. It's Liebestod. Love, death.
It is. That's what it is. Yes, exactly. Now, we're going to move on to a song, She's the One, which seems like a different kind of song, but it actually only occurred to me yesterday as I was listening to these songs that they're actually related to each other. They're in the same key. Born to Run ends with a slow fade on the tonic note, and She's the One starts with a slow fade up on the same tonic note, and they use the same four notes. A, G sharp, F sharp, and E. Da 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 da. And it's here as well. So let's have a listen.
With a tale of graces and a secret places that no more can fill. With a round on her hips, oh, and a smile on her lips, because she knows that it kills me. With a stopping scream standing in that door like a dream, I wish she'd just leave me alone. Because French dream won't stop, and them boots and French kisses will not break that heart of stone. With a long hair falling and eyes that shine like a midnight sun.
She's the One from Born to Run on its 50th birthday. We're talking about Bruce Springsteen on today's music show with Karen Goldsworthy and Toby Martin. Lovely Bo Diddley hambone rhythm there as well.
This is maybe a good moment to talk about Bruce Springsteen's kind of affection for reference to the 50s. You know, he's making this record in 1975, but we talked before about the American dream and the cars and the road and that connection to 1950s. And here, yeah, you've got the Bo Diddley rhythm, and American culture in general in the 1970s is thinking a lot about the 1950s as being this more innocent time, I suppose. I mean, that's the way it's kind of considered, and a time in which, like, love seemed kind of a bit more romantic and innocent before the, I don't know, all the political troubles of the early 1970s in America. And, of course, in the UK, a lot of, you know, the punk bands like Sex Pistols were sort of thinking about the 50s as a time of more purer rock and roll forms that a lot of prog rock had kind of, you know, desecrated. So Not that Bruce Springsteen ever really gets lumped into the punk crowd, but it's interesting that he's kind of looking at the 50s too at this moment.
Yes, yes, it is interesting, isn't it? And the whole music's past is very much present in his work, as it is in Dylan's, whose name, unaccountably, we haven't spoken yet, but is, of course, lurks behind so many of these songs. But speaking of lurking in the songs, Karen, with her Killer Graces and Secret Places. Killer Graces is an amazing phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant. It sort of sums up what the song's about in those two words, because she's the one and he can't have her. You know, it's a song about how this has already gone bad, or he's gone as far as he can go. You know, by the end, it's turned into a fight. She's going to break you. She's going to find that ain't so easy to do. There's this real wrestle going on. So Killer Graces right at the beginning kind of sets you up to understand that this isn't going to be the swoony love song that maybe the title would suggest.
No, and it's not. But I think it's a rather underrated track. And yet it's really perhaps the biggest dance number of all. And it's part because of the Hambone beat. She's the One, which gets us dancing before what for me is the big heartbreak number of the album. Suddenly, we no longer have the E Street Band. It's replaced by the piano and two jazz musicians, a trumpet and a double bass. This is Meeting Across the River. Gosh, I find this one so sad. Karen, would you like to start on this one for us?
Coming straight out of left field here, you asked me earlier about the literary aspect of some of these songs. This, I love this song with a passion. It is a really brilliant example of a poetic form called dramatic monologue. And in dramatic monologue, what happens is that you've got a speaker who's clearly not the poet. It's a persona, usually talking to another person. In the course of the poem, the person who's talking reveals himself as quite a different kind of person from the one he's making himself out to be. So it's a very difficult form of characterization where you reveal a character through what he unwittingly says about himself. This Browning poem, My Last Duchess.
Yes, one of my favourites.
That's My Last Duchess hanging on the wall. You know, the guy comes across as a murderer, basically, but he's got no idea that that's what he's like. And it's the same with this poor, sad character who has no money and no ride, but who is talking to Eddie as though Eddie was his inferior. You know, change your shirt, remember not to smile. At the same time, he's asking Eddie for money and a ride. It's just tragic. And the other thing about the dramatic monologue is that if the person's really good at what they're doing, you end up with a very, very clear picture of what the other people are like. So, you know, by the end of this song, not only do you understand what the speaker's like, you also have a really clear picture of Eddie and beyond Eddie, Cherry. There are all these people. And yeah, as Toby has said, it's everyday language. The actual language he's using is really simple, the way this character would use it. I think this song's just perfect.
But Cherry says she's gonna walk, 'cause she found I took the radio and hocked it. But Eddie, man, she don't understand that $2,000's practically sitting here in my pocket. Tonight's gonna be everything that I said. And when I walk through that door, I'm just gonna throw that money on the bed. You'll see this time I wasn't just talking. Then I'm gonna go out walking.
I think I am particularly attracted to Bruce Springsteen's songs where the narrative is really clear and it's kind of stripped back and you hear the story really well. You know, I think Bruce Springsteen is a very interesting crime writer. I'm not sure if that's exactly the right word, but, you know, he writes about violence and crime quite a lot. There's an implication that things could go badly. There's a lot of dramatic tension in there.
And things have happened.
Yes, yes.
As well.
And, you know, I guess he approaches crime, once again, from a compassionate point of view, you know, often thinking about what's led someone into this situation, how society dealt them a bad hand that's got them to this point.
There is always this little bit of optimism that this time it's going to be okay. I'm going to come in and I'm going to throw the money on the bed and that'll show her. And then I'm going to go out walking. And for me, the most heartbreaking moment is the going out walking. And it's because of what he does musically and melodically, because he doesn't go just go out walking. He goes up to the sixth, go out walking. And it's as though, you know, there's a little opportunity there for something new and fresh to happen. But it doesn't, of course.
Yeah, it does sound like he's slightly in the realm of fantasy of how things are going to turn out. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, the way the music plays out.
Just on the subject of the music, we should mention Randy Brecker's trumpet, which is glorious. I hadn't realised that Richard Davis is the bass player, and Richard Davis was the bass player for Eric Dolphy on Out to Lunch, and he was the bass player on Astral Weeks, which is a major piece of work, and he's also the bass player on Janice Ian's At 17. There's a little bit of, and a lot of other stuff as well. You could look him up, but he's a proper jazz man. Well, time to meet the final epic length track. This is Jungle Land. This is a song, Toby, which has scenes, doesn't it? I mean, episodes.
Yeah, and it's just so redolent of the city. It just sounds so city, night, noir, the saxophone, the taxis, you can sort of see it. And yeah, the episodes are very interesting. The first few times I heard Jungle Land, I considered it to be this kind of place of the city being sort of dangerous and crime and being a place in which, you know, things can go astray. And I guess there's other uses of the word jungle to describe the city like that. There's use of it in hip-hop and also Guns N' Roses, Welcome to the Jungle, you know. So there's kind of this, yeah, the city is this dangerous place, this jungle. But then listening to it again, there's actually quite a few references to music and a band starting off, and they've swapped their knives for guitars or something. So there's also this, it's very interesting narrative. I'm still not quite sure in my head how it works, but it's cool how they go, okay, now we're music and bands, and that's kind of part of this Jungle Land too.
Karen, do you know how it works?
No, but it's only just occurred to me that there's yet another really sort of cornerstone of 50s Anglophone culture in there, and that's Blackmore Jungle.
Mm.
The same kind of sense that you are in a wild place where you might get eaten by a wild animal, and that it is something to do with it being a big city, that that's got a lot to do with it. As with side one, it starts out with this at least partly optimistic, let's get out of here, let's get in the car and go type song. But by the time you get to Jungle Land, they're back where they started. They're back in the streets. They can't get away.
This song also contains the great sax solo from Clarence Clemons, doesn't it? I mean, a long one where he's, you know, to make up for being faded at the end of track one, he gets to blow and blow and blow. And it's perhaps the moment of musical transcendence that we've needed all along.
Kind of like the jungle, not as being a place that's dangerous, but also a place that creates beautiful musical moments as kind of these things emanating from jungle land, I suppose.
Mm. A really fertile place, somewhere where things grow.
Yeah, and in some ways it's like looking back at the whole record and all those vignettes and all those situations and people dealing with everyday struggles and looking for transcendence, and then it kind of reaches this big conclusion.
When it stops, that sax solo, and the organ takes over, I find it very hard not to think that we're in church suddenly. Right. It's very still. It might even be the kind of, you know, it's the kind of noodling of a church organist, as, you know, at a funeral, say, you know, as the body comes in.
If you read his autobiography, you can just see how absolutely intrinsic the Catholic Church was to his childhood, infancy, childhood, family, background, everything. And there's a point, I suppose, where in church where you just sort of, silence is what happens. You know, everything slows down and comes to a stop and you're just meditative, and maybe that's what's going on there.
Maybe it is.
It's pretty amazing for someone who has been working so hard, this amazing wall of sound that they've been creating, to then turn into that space at the end.
And then he starts talking.
Beneath the city, two hearts beat, soul engines running through a night so tender. In a bedroom locked, in whispers of soft refusal, and then surrender. In the tunnels uptown, the rats on dream guns him down.
So, was John Landau right? The future of rock and roll?
Did John Landau see the future of his bank account as well, maybe?
Maybe.
that's cynical. I don't really mean that. But yeah, in terms of the future of rock music, I mean, Bruce Springsteen is so interesting. And I think for people who grew up in the 80s, it's hard not to associate Bruce Springsteen with a very big, bombastic American stadium rock type thing. But then once you start delving into his music, he's such a rich source of inspiration, I think, for so many songwriters. And in some ways, he occupies this very interesting space where he's hugely successful, obviously, and appeals to a mass audience. But he's also someone that musicians love too. That's not always the same thing, I think. And I don't know if that's the future, but he's certainly someone who we can get so much from. It's amazing.
Karen?
He's a musician from the album era, which of course is no longer with us. We're well beyond that now. But he seems to have survived that. At the point at which music became a digital thing for consumers, a lot of the musicians who were determined to survive said, okay, well, we just have to play live. We've got to get on the road, we've got to get into the pub, we've got to play in people's houses. This is the way kind of around it. Because Springsteen was always such a fantastic performer anyway, that was just second nature to him. I think he survived the way he has largely because he's such a brilliant performer.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Karen Goldsworthy.
Thank you.
And Toby Martin.
Thank you, Andy.
For talking to me about Born to Run on its 50th birthday. It's been a pleasure. The music show this week was produced by C. Benedict and Ellie Parnell. Technical production from Harvey O'Sullivan. We're on Gadigal and Gundungurra country. This is Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band.
But outside the streets on fire and a real death waltz between what's flesh and what's fantasy. And man, the poets down here don't write nothing at all. They just stand back and let it all be. And the quicker the night, they reach for their moment. They try to make an honest stand. But they wind up wounded, but not even dead. Tonight in jungle.
Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band live in New York in 2000. Next time on the music show, the legacy of the 1960s pop group The Shangri-Las, and we head off to Walbury Country for an album and documentary project, Crown and Country.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.